You turn to Marketplace for the latest news about what's happening in the economy and how it affects you and your community. When you donate to support our nonprofit newsroom, you can also get something a little more tangible. We have a great lineup of donor thank you gifts right now. A shrinkflation mini tote bag, water bottles, mugs, hats, and a lot more. Contribute any amount to make a difference and pick up one of these gifts. Go to marketplace.org/donate.
The Supreme Court decides the fate of student loan forgiveness. From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishore, in for David Brancaccio. Is the Biden administration's plan to forgive billions in student loan debt constitutional? The Supreme Court is expected to hand down its decision in two cases around that question later today. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has more.
The Biden administration's program would eliminate some or all of the student loan debt held by more than 40 million Americans, as much as $10,000 or even $20,000 per borrower. But during oral arguments in February for two cases challenging the program, a majority of the Supreme Court justices seemed to doubt claims that the executive branch has the authority to implement such a sweeping plan. Congress may need to offer express consent. There is a second issue the justices are considering, whether the plaintiffs in the two cases have standing. That means whether they've credibly shown that they'd suffer if the plan went into effect and therefore have the right to sue. If a majority of the justices say no, the debt forgiveness program could survive on a legal technicality. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
Now that colleges and universities can no longer consider race in admissions, the percentage of racial minorities enrolled in selective colleges is probably going to go down in the coming years, at least at first. That's what happened in states that previously eliminated affirmative action. So, following the Supreme Court's decision yesterday, schools that still want to have racially diverse student bodies will likely try other strategies. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has more.
Since colleges can no longer legally consider what race applicants are, more schools may start considering what socioeconomic class they are. Brian Cook is director of higher education policy at the Urban Institute.
So class-based affirmative action is essentially giving a significant weight to students who come from lower-income households.
The idea is that disproportionately, Black, Latino, and Indigenous populations tend to be lower-income, and such a policy could lead to both economic and racial diversity. But Cook points out a lot of low-income students are also white. So
that in and of itself doesn't guarantee that you're going to have a racially diverse group of students.
Another possible strategy? Get rid of or reduce legacy admissions, which give preference to the children of alumni. These applicants are more likely to be admitted at some highly selective colleges. Congressman Jamal Bowman of New York has filed legislation that would ban the practice.
Legacy admissions benefit white people and benefit the wealthiest among us and keep poor people and Black people and people of color out of schools.
But those wealthy people are also a major source of revenue for schools. Colleges rely on them for fundraising, and schools want to stay connected to alumni for reasons other than the financial. Again, Brian Cook of Urban.
Legacy admits have been around for a reason. Just completely eliminating them is not an easy decision for institutions to make.
Higher education is still, at its core, a business, and these schools don't want to alienate any of their customers. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
You turn to Marketplace for the latest news about what's happening in the economy and how it affects you and your community. When you donate to support our nonprofit newsroom, you can also get something a little more tangible. We have a great lineup of donor thank you gifts right now. A shrinkflation mini tote bag, water bottles, mugs, hats, and a lot more. Contribute any amount to make a difference and pick up one of these gifts. Go to marketplace.org/donate.
A new federal law went into effect earlier this week aiming to protect pregnant and postpartum workers. Up till now, safeguards for pregnant workers have not been entirely effective. Marketplace's David Brancaccio spoke with Jillian Thomas, a senior staff attorney at the ACLU's Women's Rights Project, about the details of the new law.
There have been protections in place for pregnant workers, but there were holes in the system from your point of view.
There were major gaps. The Americans with Disabilities Act provides for accommodations for workers with disabilities, but pregnancy, at least without complications, is recognized to not constitute a disability. But the Pregnancy Discrimination Act only protected pregnant workers needing those kinds of accommodations to the extent that the employer provided those accommodations to others similar in their ability or inability to work. And for years, both employers and the courts have been struggling with defining who is similar. And frequently it was decided to the detriment of the pregnant worker.
Give us a sense, who should be really focused on this? Who stands to benefit the most from the effects of this law?
Millions of workers who are in jobs that are physically demanding are going to be the chief beneficiaries of this new statute. And that ranges from low-wage workers who do really physically strenuous work, whether it's retail workers who are on their feet all day long, custodians who work with hazardous chemicals, workers like nurses or home health aides who lift patients in and out of bed. And the workers who are in those positions are disproportionately Black and brown women, women who, by the way, are at greatest risk of complications from pregnancy. And then there are also the women who are working in jobs that are historically male-dominated, where the employer may not even have thought about pregnancy much before.
So in virtually every case, process would start with a conversation between employees and manager. But if the employee doesn't like the answer, I guess part number two would be, hey, there's a new law in effect.
That's right. Really, the hope is that this statute is not going to lead to lots and lots of new litigation, but is actually going to avoid litigation. The interactive process that's been in place for so long under the ADA is something that employers are now practiced at. And it involves the worker coming forward with describing what their limitations are, what they can and can't do, the employer providing some different alternatives, and the employee maybe comes back and says, well, I can do that, but not this. And hopefully a resolution comes about relatively quickly and cooperatively. In the worst case scenario, when that's not possible, then the next step is, yes, going to the enforcement regime.
Julian Thomas is a senior staff attorney at the ACLU's Women's Rights Project. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.